This is the Mooks and the Gripes podcast. Hello, everybody. This is Trevor, and walking in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies, Paul. Paul, how are you doing today?
Oh, my. Now I'm feeling a little poetic. Discombobulated. Yeah, poetic. But how am I going to live up to it, I guess, is the question.
You live up to it every day, Paul. Oh. You just don't know it, I guess.
Well, thank you. Jeez, who needs poetry?
It's our job to help you see that in this episode.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't need to read poetry. I'll just have Trevor follow me around like a hype man and just constantly make me feel great.
There we are.
No, I'm doing great. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Well, and the we I'm talking about is someone that has certainly hyped us up, making my heart with pleasure fill by dancing with the daffodils. Anthony, we're so excited to have you on our show today. Welcome.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Trevor and Paul, both of you.
Yeah, and I think most of our listeners probably know who you are, follow you online and such. But for those who don't yet, will you tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, how you wander around online and all of that?
Yeah, there's nothing special to share, but I'm Anthony Garrett. I'm the editor of a new online literary magazine, Atmospheric Quarterly, and a novelist. I'm very close to completing a draft of not my first draft of a novel, but my first draft of a novel that I'm taking seriously, I guess. And yeah, people can find me almost everywhere online at Anth Garrett, two R's, two T's. And it's just, I'm a longtime fan of both of you, and I'm just so happy to be here.
Well, and I did see this week, maybe you need some a hype person as well. You suggested that you're in that stage where all the doubts are coming to fruition on your novel. Is that something that just comes up and down, or are you still feeling it? Or
that's something that comes up and down. I don't know if it's because of this, because my writing group is so kind, but I sent 160 pages of my novel off to my writing group this week. And so I was in a little spot of vulnerability for a second, like, oh, I've been working on this thing, but I actually, people are going to read these words, and maybe that brought up all of those feelings.
Oh boy. Well, good luck with it. I'm very excited. I have had the chance, listeners, I think we've shared this on the podcast, but I've had the chance to meet with Anthony a few times. We don't live that far away from each other. Once was just my wife and I going to a bookstore with Anthony, and the other time we met Anthony up at the King's English in Salt Lake City with Dorian Stuber. Dorian, fortunately, even though we often suggest that he must always be mad at us, wasn't so mad that he wouldn't meet with me last year.
It's a good sign. It's a good test.
It was nice. And so I'm already looking forward to the next time Anthony shared a picture of his Reuben breakfast. You know, that was like 9:15 in the morning that you shared that post.
That was meant to be from the night before.
I didn't care. I was like, that is a good breakfast.
Yeah, I would eat it.
So, and I thought, well, I need to figure out where that place is, and who better to show me?
Yeah, looked amazing.
All right.
Anytime, well, I'm ready.
It's that time of year where the weather has changed, and I feel like maybe I can start creeping out of my cave, you know?
Yep.
All right. Well, we would love to start with the question of what have you been reading? And let's start with you, Anthony. We'll keep Paul quiet for a little bit longer.
our listeners, thank you.
Well, on the topic that we'll eventually get to, I have a poetry reading group that I meet with online most Sundays, and we go through just a few pages of a collection every Sunday. We read the poetry aloud, and then we sort of discuss it, not quite line by line, but we give ourselves enough time that we can say everything that we would want to say about it. And so we as a group just finished the late Louise Glick's collection Averno. So I just finished that recently.
Oh, awesome.
And that was an amazing experience to be able to read it and discuss it as a group. It's in a lot of ways her discussion of the Persephone myth. And so it has a lot of different poems that sometimes take Persephone's perspective, sometimes just take what seem like an autobiographical perspective, sometimes take, in rare instances, Hades' perspective, and it's quite a collection. So that was an amazing experience. And then I just started, New Directions was kind enough to send me an advanced copy, but they just sent me the somewhat intimidating The Obscene Bird of Night by Jose Donoso. We actually hope to be publishing a review. A review might not be the right word, but someone is going to be responding to the book for Atmospheric Quarterly in our next issue. We have a really actually incredible writer that's going to write a few things about the book, but it's both intimidating in size and in and in density of language, but it's quite a rewarding experience.
Oh, that's awesome. I have that one too, but I haven't, I cracked it to like, what is this thing I'm holding in my hands now? And yeah, you're right. Intimidation is the word, but I have inherent trust in New Directions. You know,
absolutely.
They could send me anything and I'd be like, I didn't get that. I thought it was awful, but I know it was great.
Might've been a phone book, but I loved it.
There was
the way they were brave enough and creative enough to publish those numbers in that order.
Exactly. There's a really great introduction by Alejandro Zambra at the beginning too. I can at least say that I finished the introduction it both gave me a lot of perspective, maybe about my own approach, because he sort of discusses reading it as a student and trying to have it be this intellectual exercise where he was keeping track of everything and how he didn't have quite the rewarding experience that he had hoped for. But then later on, he read it and just sort of let the whole novel wash over him and it changed his experience with it.
Very cool.
That appeals to me because, as I've said, that's something I love to do with difficult novels, is if you can find that spot where you find the right balance and kind of just let it wash over you is a perfect way to say it.
I'm learning still. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks a lot to when Paul says that too. It's been helpful. Yeah. All right, Paul, how about you? What have you been reading? I don't think you've responded on Instagram yet, so this is a surprise for me.
Oh yeah. See, I wanted to keep you, you know, out of it for a
little
while.
I couldn't sleep last night, Paul.
Got to keep you on your toes. So yeah, I've been reading a couple things, as everyone will be shocked to hear. But over the last few years, I've been hearing so many people raving about Sergio de la Plava's book, A Naked Singularity. And I've been kind of eyeing it, not sure what to do. You know, Chris Villa, among many other people, has just said so many great things about it. And so I finally decided to check it out. And the way I decided to approach it was as an audiobook. And so, as I often do with audiobooks, you know, during my walks, my rambles, and my commutes and things like that, I've been listening to that and just really, really enjoying the experience. It's a really strange book. It's a really fascinating book. It's hard to summarize, so I'm going to cheat a little bit and just read a little bit from the description, because I think it does a nice job of touching on, you know, just the variety of things that are included in the book. So it says it's a huge, ambitious novel in the vein of DeLillo, Foster Wallace, Pynchon, and even Melville. And it's told in a distinct, frequently hilarious voice with a striking human empathy at its center. And then some of the things it mentions touching on is crime and courts, immigrant families, urban blight, media savagery and satire, boxing, and even a breathless heist worthy of a crime novel. And so I thought that did a nice job of summarizing. This book is all over the place in a lot of ways.
Just a couple things.
You know, it's so weird. And I really like the Pynchon and Foster Wallace comparisons, because I haven't read a lot of their stuff, but I think that's a really good pairing. And so, like I said, I've been listening to it on audio, and it's been working so well for me, because I have to admit, something that's described as a legal thriller with a hilarious voice would normally not be something that would draw me in. But the reader of this book does such an amazing job of capturing the different voices and the humor. But there's like these long sections where it'll just go off on the history of like boxing in the 80s. And it'll just be talking about these bouts that took place. And again, it's not something like that would leap off the page to me normally, but it's working so well for me, to the point where I'm actually wondering if at some point I might not get the physical copy and do a little reading just to see if it's would have worked as well for me, you know, in a different format. But anyway, it's been really fascinating. I can jump over to my next one, but have you read that one, Anthony, or have you read it, Trevor?
I've not. I just got a copy. Is it University of Chicago Press? Which
it is a university press, and I think that's right.
Yeah, I just got it through a sale that they had a few months
ago. Oh, yeah. I almost picked it up there, too. Yeah. Nice. Well, whenever you get to it, you'll have to let me know. But anyway, I'm actually very near the end. I took a long walk last night and made it through pretty much the rest of it. So just a couple pages to finish it off. But yeah, it's been a really fun and fascinating, weird book. The other one, speaking of our friend Dorian, this will be another brownie point on our good side. I finally picked up Border by Kapka Kasabova, which is one of his favorite authors in a book series that he loves. It's been, again, another one that's been on my radar for a long time, and he's been kind of nicely urging me to pick it up because of what he knows about my reading tastes and, you know, nature writing, and also just, you know, a lot of other things that it touches on. I owned her other book, To the Lake, and I didn't realize that they were part of this kind of loose series, and so I was getting ready to read that one time, and he's like, no, you have to read Border first. So picked that up, and yeah, it's been great. It's actually been a really fascinating pairing because I'm still making my way through Black Lamb and Gray Falcon. And there's, again, a lot of commonalities there, which I should have realized heading into it, but I just decided to pick it up one day and got into it. And I was like, oh, yeah, it makes total sense. But yeah, it's described as narrative reportage. And it follows Kasabova as she returns to Bulgaria after having immigrated about 25 years previously as a child. And so, yeah, as the title Border implies, it's all about migration, immigration, the landscapes and people of that area. There's a lot about mythology. And then, of course, yeah, lots of great nature writing, which I'm very happy about. So, yeah, it's ticking a lot of boxes for me. I'm not real far in, but loving it so far. And, yeah, looking forward to it. There's two more out, and I think a fourth one that's
going to be published. Yeah, the fourth that comes out this year.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's been great.
Sorry, Paul, I owe you an apology. You did respond and say you're reading Border.
Okay.
And I went back and found an old picture I took of the stack of the three that were out in order to post on it. I apologize. I actually stopped and was like, oh, good. I think Paul will love this book.
Nice. So. Yeah. No, I might have. I didn't know if I sent it too late in the evening for you to get on it, but you're always, you know, vigilant. So I should have known you had it.
No, this is how vigilant I am. People come and go and I forget, I guess. my apologies.
No, no.
I could have slept last night.
That's right. I
didn't know what was going on. All right. Well, I have some big news that I'll share with the two of you. I finally finished. I started it on September 1st, War and Peace.
Nice.
There we are. Congratulations. I did it. Awesome. I read that epilogue part two. And I thought, I actually finished this a few days ago. Because that stuff was just for the people who want to really dig in on the book. But I did enjoy it. It was on our first episode that I said that I had kicked War and Peace off of my bucket list and decided I'd never feel the need to read it again. But with Paul's pressure campaign.
That's right.
And... last year with Leaf by Leaf posting a 6.5 hour video on War and Peace and on Chris Villa, you know, talking about his reading experience and deciding to go with the Anthony Briggs translation and then thinking, I'll just do this a chapter a day. I didn't do that because that would have taken me a whole year and I finished it in just under 7 months. But you know, it was a goal that I met every day except for when I was sick in February, and then I caught up fairly quickly and went through it all. And it was ups and downs in terms of how engaged I was with whatever was on the page. I didn't care too much about Kutuzov and the war chapters and Tolstoy's efforts to rehabilitate his reputation, and you know, some of the meanderings on historians, which is really, you know, I think interesting, but I did get a little tired of it interrupting the narrative. And I just kind of realized, you know, there are people, I know this is their catnip, and this is a big baggy monster of a book. It's totally fine that it is there, but I'm very used to narrative, and I would never write a book where I left some central characters for hundreds of pages in the dust. And all of that, but I was very satisfied with the stories and the very, very real life and deeply psychological characters and what they were going through. So it was a good experience. I'm very glad that I did it at this point.
Yeah.
And it never felt like a big chore because of the approach that I had, as I've kind of mentioned before. So that's done. I did it. I did
that's
it.
Amazing.
Very
that's
excited.
So cool.
Well done.
Congratulations. Yeah. Have you, I forget, weren't you saving parts of the Chris Villa video because you didn't want to spoil it? So are you going to go in and, or have you already gone in and...
Well, so he has bookmarks where he segments. And so when he's done with part one, he'll talk about that.
Hmm.
And then he'll go off and read for another, you know, however many days it took him or weeks, I don't know. And he'd read book two and then come on and record another thing. So I would go through it like that, kind of in live. Like, I just finished book one. Let's act as if we're getting together and chatting about that. I silently and him, you know, kind of going through his insights. And it was, I really loved his video. He still has several hours left of his video because then he goes into the criticism and biography and, you know, other side reading. And I haven't gotten there yet.
It's amazing.
But I did finish the epilogue section that he put just yesterday, actually. Yeah, I finished the book yesterday and then I listened to the epilogue. You know, it's 10, 15 minutes or 20 minutes, depending on the various pieces. So it was nice. It was nice.
Very cool. That's exciting.
Now I don't know. I was like, I've been reading this whole time, but I don't know what to read.
So I was going to say, you're going to have to find another doorstop to fill that hole in your life.
I'm kind of feeling that. I'll have to think about that and I'll let you know, of course.
Nice.
But the other book that I'm reading, I think might interest you, Paul. Anthony, you might too, but just from knowing Paul's taste, and maybe you've even read it. Have you read or heard of The Fisherman by John Langan?
I've heard of it, but I have not read it.
So I've just heard good things about it. It's kind of a horror novel. Yeah. And, you know, we've talked about horror novels on the podcast. They're always a bit of a, I don't know if I'll enjoy it as much as I hope to.
Right.
This one has a epigram by... from Moby Dick, so that's a point in its favor. And then this is how it starts. Don't call me Abraham. Call me Abe. Though it's what my ma named me, I've never liked Abraham. It's a name that sounds so full of itself, so biblical, so... I believe patriarchal is the word I'm after. One thing I am not, nor do I want to be, is a patriarch. There was a time I thought I'd at least like one child, but these days the sight of them makes my skin crawl. Some years ago, never mind how many, I started to fish. I've been fishing for a long time now, and as you might guess, I know a story or two. That's what fishermen are, right? Storytellers. Some I've lived, some I've had from the mouths of others. Most of them are funny. They bring a smile to your face, and sometimes a laugh, which are no small thing. A bit of laughter can be the bridge that lets you cross out of a bad time, believe you me. Some of my stories are what I'd call strange. I know only a few of these, but they make you scratch your head and maybe give you a little shiver, which can be a pleasure in its own way. Anyway, I love the conversational but still well-written tone. I love all of the Moby Dick references in that section. And I was along for the ride for sure. I'm almost done. I think I'll finish it today or tomorrow, just depending on how everything goes. But I'll be in thinking about this. The first section is this fisherman who's first person protagonist telling his story. And it is filled with grief and loss and trying to find a way. And I thought this might be, if not one of my in my top five, but definitely in my top 10 books of the year. This is amazing. Very surprising, but also just amazing. Because I wasn't expecting that. It then, for a significant portion of the novel, like most of the novel, goes into a background story on this region and on this, you know, to kind of develop the horror lore. And I find that less compelling, still interesting, but less compelling. It's in the third person at this point because it's talking about, you know, it is someone telling the story. So it's still kind of got that conversational sit down and I'll tell you a story kind of vibe. But it's not as, it's not connecting with me as much as the first part, but I am still really liking it. And my brother-in-law who did finish it and said, I think you'll really like it. says that the ending is, you know, superb. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it kind of ties together and if it makes it back into that realm that I had it in at the beginning. But the right, it has been very compelling, very captivating. I've really been enjoying it. I kind of think it might be up your alley, Paul. And yeah, I have been listening to it, and the reader is just fantastic. I can't remember who it is, but very, very good reader. So there you nice. Go. Long walk after you finish Naked Singularity.
Absolutely. No, that sounds great. I'll add it to my list right now. And I was going to ask you how it came onto your radar. So that's cool. I always like all the different avenues that books that maybe wouldn't necessarily have crossed your path end up doing so. That's fun.
Well, on TikTok, I see a lot of book talk. There's a lot of the stuff on there that I just, you know, it's not for me, but there are those who do horror or fantasy or science fiction. And I tend to watch those a little bit to see if it's any that strike a vibe with me. And that's where I found out about The Fisherman the first time. And I told my brother-in-law about it. And then, you know, he kind of then read it and then reversed the recommendation.
Oh, so, cool.
It's a good way to fish it out, you know, and see, should I read this? You tell me.
Right. It's like your own personal wine taster to make sure it's not poison.
Yes, exactly.
It's not very often that a book actually makes me laugh. And as you were reading, at least that introduction is pretty funny, especially with the way that it's playing off of Melville. I wonder if those sections that weren't as interesting to you about the region and everything are the book's equivalent of the Cetology chapters from Moby Dick.
It could. So it's a Lovecraftian horror. And even in Lovecraft, I loved his setups. You know, like there's that house up on the mountain that hasn't had lights on for decades, and there's a light on. And, you know, you've got these thinkers and these conversationalists and people who speak literary prose, you know, and that's kind of how this book was. And I'm always a little bit less interested when they're actually encountering the beast. And that's kind of how this one is too. It's because I love those weird chapters in Moby Dick, and it's more that he's venturing into the action-y kind of parts.
Oh, that makes sense.
Of it that I'm like, I don't need the action apparently.
Yeah. That does sound like in the horror tradition, like you said, not to say that there aren't some horror novels that have worked completely for me, but so often, like you said, the setup is so great and there's these moments of greatness, but I don't know. Chasing that high.
Well, we've got one more thing to do before we get to our topic. We have just been imposing ourselves on Anthony's time, and we're still not there. But I know that some of our listeners will be interested, so let's do it now in our book giveaway. Yeah. Folks may remember that we put up 4 books for giveaway, and we got a little bit of feedback on completionism from various sources, because that was part of the ticket to get your entry in. Mm-hmm. But even from some people who said, I don't need any of these books, but, you know, giving us their thoughts. One that I thought we should share is Cynthia Murphy's, because it suggests a different form of completionism that I think all of us can appreciate. And she says, I would like to be a coffee house books and charcoal press completionist.
So many books.
Yeah. I love that approach. And you know, I know all of us are like publishers or curators, and we have the curators that we trust. And yeah, we're happy to read any of them. We just talked about this with New Directions. She says maybe a Europa partialist. Here to find is just having read a whole bunch of Europas. And then these days I'm feeling individual publishing houses over individual authors. I think that's a fair way of looking at completionism. So, and with charcoal press in particular, you could do that.
You could catch up pretty quickly. And then, absolutely. I love that.
But there were a couple more that I thought we should share too, that had just some different approaches or some things that we didn't talk about in that episode. Do you want to read the next one, Paul?
Yeah, from Ethan? I will. Yeah, it's from Ethan. He says, this year I'm making an attempt to do a complete tour of sorts since I loved Song of Solomon so much last year, so I knew I needed to read all of Toni Morrison. There are 11 Toni Morrison books and one short story. That gives me one Morrison work a month, with one skipped month for Song of Solomon. And at the end of the year, I can say I've read all of her work. Considering how great they've been so far, I've been really enjoying them. and a month is enough time between them to get back into it.
Yeah, I like the idea of figuring out how to approach an author. And the, you know, Willa Cather wrote 12 novels, so you can do that. I remember it was Thomas on The Readers who said that, you know, 1 year when they were talking about their, you know, probably 2012, it's been a little while, reading goals. He said he'd like to read one book of hers a month and get through hers. He'd read maybe all of them before that, but just as a goal. And I thought that's kind of a fun way. Spend a year with an author. Another one, I think Elizabeth Taylor has 12. So that's, you could cool. do that with her as well.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. And then the last one we'll share, and then we'll get to the drawing, is from Russell McGee. Russell McGee. completionist? Yes, indeed. And then I really like how he puts that, because this is how I feel. Though perhaps aspiring completionist is more apt to say, as exactly. I can think of only two writers whose entire works I've read so far, W.G. Zabald and Flannery O'Connor. But I'm getting close with several others. And I just thought, that's me too. Like, there are all these, yeah, I'm a completionist. I haven't really done it, but right. I am aspiring. And it was interesting because Baz Reads on Instagram is just about done with, who was it that he was finishing up? Oh, Muriel Spark on Instagram. And he talked about, he linked to our podcast that, you know, he does not like to think of these as projects. It's something that for him happens naturally over time because he loves the author. And I thought, yeah, I think that's, you know, even though I look at some of these as projects, like I'd like to get through that person's work, I've never thrown everything out the window in order to make it a project and focus on it. It has to be what I'm feeling. Yeah. Like, if I'm just not in the mood for another Virginia Woolf novel at this time, then for me, it would be a bad experience to force it upon myself, because then I'm kind of losing the goal of the, you know, the goal being, I want to enjoy this author's works that I love. And if I make it a project, it's possible I could ruin that. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was a good insight. And maybe being an aspiring completionist is a good way to kind of look at that. So
yeah, I love that.
I will say that Russell is part of our Savage Detectives read along. And he says, I must say, reading the Savage Detectives with this wonderful group has proven to be a thrilling experience. Just so, so, so much fun. So I agree with that. We've lost people along the way.
Yes.
It's not as vibrant as it was at the beginning. And some people who were commenting at the start, I think, either quit or fell behind and don't want to tell us, or, you know, drowned in the water. and I want everybody to feel comfortable to say, this didn't work for me, or I lost the thread, or I just got busy. It's totally fine.
I'll admit there's been several times, including now, where I've fallen a little bit behind. And so I'll have a little catching up to do this weekend. It's bound to happen with any book project, but especially something like Savage Detectives, which is, you know, it's intense.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we will have to change our schedule just a little bit, because our folks who are joining us to talk about the Savage Detectives couldn't join on the week we were going to do it. So we're rescheduling that. We will still have a podcast on the Savage Detectives and Roberto Bolaño in general, but it won't be... I think it was going to be our next episode, but it won't be now. So, and that's okay. That's how we do these things. We're aspiring to do these episodes. So, all right, time for the drawing. We did this before pre-show so that we wouldn't have to take a ton of time, since we got four books. And Paul, do you want to announce the winner, our first winner, who won a copy of Rock Crystal from your library? Even though it was a new copy.
Yes, I am ready. So congratulations to Every Book a Picture, who we know from Instagram.
Yeah, I'll reach out to you. Some people, I just don't know if they want us to share their actual names rather than their handles. So that's why we do it like this. But yes, Every Book a Picture, look them up on Instagram. You'll love their account if you listen to this podcast. So
absolutely.
Congratulations, you getting a copy of Rock Crystal. The winner of The End is Valerie Hamilcar Barca. Congratulations, Valerie. We'll get in touch so we know where to send that one. The next one is Divorcing, Paul. Who is that?
Yeah, congratulations to Susan Dillon. copies coming your way.
Susan, a longtime listener and commenter and contributor, I'm very excited you won. That was the only one of these that she was wanting to win, and we didn't put our hands on the scales.
No.
You won that, and it happened to be on our drawing of divorcing.
Book people just have good karma. That's all there is.
That's right. And then Notes of a Crocodile goes to Carmen Melian. So we'll reach out to get those figured out and where to send those. Congratulations, everybody.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like we need to get talking about some poetry.
Probably better.
Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Always.
Oh, boy, that's a lot of preliminary stuff. Listeners, feedback. Let us know if we do too much of this, and then we'll share your feedback in the next. You know.
That will be the prologue.
That's right. At this point, everybody knows what they're getting into, I think, yeah, including Anthony. So.
We like talking about books, right? I'm pretty that's sure right. That's why we're here.
Exactly.
All right. We are here today to celebrate the start of National Poetry Month. It is the month of April. We're recording this at the end of March, but we're feeling April-y, I think. Mm-hmm. And I always love that April is National Poetry Month because I can't help it every April when it starts thinking April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. I mean, I love The Wasteland, T.S. Eliot's poem, and I love that in April when, frankly, I'm always feeling springy. You know, I am not one of these who thinks April is the cruelest month, but I love that poem, and I love that introduction, and I love that that's what I think of more than Chaucer. You know, I don't think of going on a pilgrimage necessarily, but I do always think April is the cruelest month. And just to introduce, and I, Paul, I know I've been talking a lot, but a little bit more introduction. This is how I feel when it comes to April and thinking of National Poetry Month. This is a poem called Today by Billy Collins. I've talked about Billy Collins on the podcast before. If ever there were a spring day so perfect, so uplifted by a warm intermittent breeze that it made you want to throw open all the windows in the house and unlatch the door to the canary's cage, indeed, rip the little door from its jam. A day when the cool brick paths in the garden bursting with peonies seemed so etched in sunlight that you feel like taking a hammer to the glass paperweight on the living room end table, releasing the inhabitants from their snow-covered cottage so they could walk out, holding hands and squinting into this larger dome of blue and white. Well, today is just that kind of day. I'm feeling it today. I'm so excited to talk poetry with you both. It has been wonderful to prepare for this episode. Mm. So I wanted to just kind of get some of your thoughts on poetry and your preparation for the episode. You know, does poetry, and, you know, Anthony, you're involved in a poetry reading group. Paul, I know this episode has always kind of been one that you're like, I love poetry, but I don't. It's not necessarily my wheelhouse or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you feeling about today? Are you more like, you know, did it open up your soul to prepare for this episode, or were you like, ugh?
A little of one, a little of the other? No, I think preparing for this episode has been kind of like my entire relationship with poetry. Very excited and aspirational, but also very intimidated and feeling a little bit out of my depth. Or at least, like, I'm not sure how I want to approach it. So, yeah, it mirrors, like I said, that's kind of how I feel about poetry in general. I've always loved it. I've always been drawn to it. But there's also this level of feeling like I'm not worthy, or like I'm a little intimidated by it. And that comes and goes. It's not always there. But it might be what keeps me from, you know, making it an even more regular part of my reading life. But that said, there's something about it that always draws me back. I always have a couple collections of poetry on my nightstand table. Sometimes they're covered in dust because, like, for some of the reasons I just talked about, but they're always there. And then whenever I dip back into it, you know, I'm always so glad that I did.
Is one of those dusty volumes Emily Dickinson?
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And Louise, is it Gluck? Is that, I never know how to say her name.
I've just heard recently from others, Glick.
Glick.
I don't know if that's
Glick. Well, I have a copy of her, let's see, poems 1962 to 2012 that have that cool picture of Saturn on the front. Yeah. So that one's on there too. And so, yeah, anyway, but yeah, it's one of those where it's funny because it's, in some ways it doesn't make sense because poetry is one of those things that you can dip in and out of pretty easily. And so there, in some ways it seems like it wouldn't be very intimidating, but I think that for whatever reason, and we can get into that in a little bit, I still kind of have that hang up a little bit sometimes.
Interesting. I have some thoughts on that for sure. But before I go into that, Anthony, kind of walk us through, well, you know, introduce your poetry side of your life however you want that to go.
Yeah, there's several ways that one could maybe do that sort of introduction, right? Like I could talk about 16-year-old Anthony writing really painful poems about the girl that didn't like him back, or I could talk about all of the classes that I took as a student. And actually, I probably will mention some of those poets just because of the teachers and professors who really opened literature up to me. One of the things that has been really important to me about poetry is a lot of my favorite novelists are also poets. And I'm often drawn to the type of language that a novelist who is also a poet would use. I, as a writer myself, I'm sometimes a little sad that I maybe didn't seek out that path first to have the same command over the language that like a Michael Ondaatje would maybe have, who was really influential for me. And there aren't a lot of people who I can say this about, but one of the few writers that I've been a completionist with. Like both of you, I'm also really drawn to nature writing, and almost always, even if it's not their main topic, it seems like poets always return to nature in their descriptions. And that's something that I really enjoy as well. But I am always drawn to just really big, giant novels with maximalist language. And it's interesting that poetry is often so small and the language is so precise and condensed, but I feel an affinity between maybe like a Moby Dick and an Emily Dickinson, even though there's so much difference in the form between those two things. But I just love reading poetry. It always enriches my relationship to literature and to the language. And that's especially important to me as I'm trying to accomplish my own writing.
I love that. Can I just jump in and ask both of you, like, how do you approach poetry? Is it something that you read every day? Is it something that you have fits and starts? Sometimes you're into it and you read like a big chunk of a collection all at once, or like, how do you, I would just be curious to hear how you approach it.
Go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah. I mean, all three of us are fairly online in literary spaces. And so whether I am attempting to or not, I feel that I'm always just encountering poetry because it's something that is more digestible in that space. And so people are often sharing just little photos of one page poems, or sometimes a poem might be short enough that it could even fit in the 280 characters of a tweet. I, as we were getting started, before we started recording, I talked about how disorganized my office space is right now. And I'm always sort of trying to come up with the perfect system for how to organize my books. But a poetry collection, I can read through it. I can read through an entire collection in one sitting if I want to. But also, as I'm doing all of that organizing, there's almost always a collection nearby that I can read a line or two just by opening a book. And because of the care that most poets take with the language, have an experience that's different than feeling the necessity to sit down for a long time the way that you might with a big novel like War and Peace.
I love that.
For me, it is fits and starts, but I don't know why. It's something I'd like to change, because preparing for this episode reminded me of all the times in my life where poetry helps me feel like I've woken up. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, I took a poetry class and I loved it. You know, we weren't just I loved my literature classes where we would study the, you know, the poets, you know, the romantics and such. Oh man, I loved those. And they also made me feel like I was kind of waking up in some ways. But the poetry class also made me realize, because the teacher had chosen books that were new. You know, mm-hmm. That's where I first read Billy Collins and another poet that I'll bring up a little bit later, Stephen Dunn. You know, those books, and I think that's the first place that I read Louise Glick as well. Just, oh man, it was amazing, because I thought, oh, I didn't know people wrote poetry anymore. You know, this was a long time ago. You know, I was young, and it made me have the goal. I'm going to go and buy more new poetry, and I'll do that for a period, and then I'll stop, because I start to realize I'm not always following the thread. I don't actually know which ones are ones I'm going to be loving. And so it tends to be around the time of the National Book Award, because they have a prize for collections of poetry, that I really dig in. And I've found so many books on those lists over the years that have just, man, they have meant something to me. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be the way that I find all of that. And so, in fact, I'll just put on here, one of our listeners, Gavin, one of our librarian friends, mm-hmm. he talked about Frank Bidart's Half-Light, collected poems from 1965 to 2016. This is one that won the National Book Award. It's also one that's so big, it's a collection, that I didn't get it. It's like 700 pages. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to now, because he says, this was one of the greatest reading experiences of my life. The fact that it happened during COVID probably played a part. The versatility and diversity of thought and language use and subjects and themes is truly astounding. And I loved that, because I've had that experience. It's been years ago, and it was before he wrote his poem Gabriel about his son, but Edward Hirsch's collected poems. That was another one of those just experiences where I'm like, I love to read. I get novels and, you know, other kinds of books in the mail. There's something different when a poetry book sings to me, though. And of course, I have plenty of those experiences where they don't. And those maybe are the times when I go, oh, okay. And I stop buying them, not because I'm disappointed or think, oh, I must have been foolish. That ship has sailed. It just falls out of my reading lineup. Mm-hmm. But I would like to be a more intentional poetry reader, because I really, really do enjoy it. And again, preparing for this episode and reading poems that have been some of my favorites over the years, almost for the first time, mm-hmm. again, I love that a page can make me at the end of it sit back in my chair and just think or meditate. I'm not thinking about anything. I'm feeling something. I love that moment. And, you know, it can be intense. I love the thing that I need to slow down. And I also love not understanding. I love, and I'm getting more comfortable with, uncertainty and not knowing, and realizing that that's a very powerful, you know, invigorating and stimulating and healthy place to be. And poetry kind of helps get into that. You know, I don't have to crack these poems to have a beautiful reading experience. So that just kept happening. Again, reading poems I've always loved for years. Mm-hmm. Just still had that power to captivate. And of course, then it led to some other poems that I maybe hadn't read ever. And it was awesome. So how do I approach poetry? Not very well, but I'd like to do better.
Yeah.
Trevor, you're making me think about John Keats' ideas about negative capability, which is that ability to sit in uncertainty, that ability mm-hmm. to sit in not knowing. It's interesting, right, that Keats had such a profound influence on literature and poetry when he lived such a short time. Mm-hmm. And also that so much of his influence came from his letters. That's the place where he described his ideas like negative capability. But he's had this just profound influence on most of the poetry that has followed. I really, really appreciate your description, in part because, as I think both of you were describing, one of the things that can often happen in poetry, and I love educators, so I'm not blaming your high school English teacher, but a lot of what can happen is that it can be conveyed in a way as if there's some skeleton key that you don't have that unlocks the answer of what poetry is. But most of all, more than the other forms, more than the other genre of literature, poetry is experiential. It is about rhythm and sound. And so it is creating not just an intellectual experience, but an embodied, sensuous experience. And I think we forget that when we talk about it and when it's taught that, oh, no, it's okay. You say you didn't get it, but I think you did because you had these feelings that you can't quite explain. Mm. You had an experience that was maybe even beyond your ability to put into words. And wow, what else would a writer want than to help someone have that kind of experience?
Yeah, I love that. I think it's funny because with a lot of literature, I've come to really embrace the idea of being okay with not understanding and just kind of letting it, like we said earlier, wash over me. So it's very interesting to me that sometimes with poetry, that's probably one of the things that I've been hung up on. And it's funny that it happens to me for poetry, but not necessarily in other forms of literature. And I think some of it is what you just said, allowing yourself that permission to just view it that way, you know. And I think what you said could be very much a part of it is, like, some of my best experiences with poetry were in classrooms. And in many ways, I miss that line by line discussing, you know, getting historical context, looking at the actual, like, nuts and bolts of how the poem was put together. I loved that. And I really miss that in a lot of ways. But I do think that it can lead to that idea of where you're overanalyzing a poem. And if you don't understand every word and every line, you feel like you're missing it and you're an outsider. So I really like that idea of continuing to not struggle with, but embrace the idea of, with poetry, just letting it be what it is and just sitting with it.
Yeah, Paul, I wonder if there's that kind of balance of having a class that forces you to reread a poem and not just be like, oh, I didn't get that and move on, but also not having a class that forces you to murder.
Yeah.
Every word of the poem. And I've had great teachers too, who allowed for that space and allowed for the poem to inspire and promote conversation versus, you know, pure direction. Of course, there are bad takes on a poem. There are dumb takes or things that just don't make sense.
Right.
But I think in good faith that's pretty rare when you have people who are, you know, in this for the reasons that I think we are, you know, we want the experience and we're okay with all of that. And my thoughts on your kind of thinking, do you think that you do feel, I'm trying to figure out, because not because of just you, but, you know, I have felt that before. Of a lot of poetry can feel a little bit intimidating. It's a different, mm-hmm. Realm, you know, especially current, you know, poetry of the last 50 years has sometimes gotten really tricky mm-hmm. and it makes it feel like it might be somewhat inaccessible. And I do wonder if some of that intimidation factor is there when it's really probably just a little bit unfamiliar.
Yeah.
And worth digging into. But I don't know. Do you feel that, like, you go to the poetry shelves at the bookstore and they're new books, and it's like, I don't know which of these are going to talk to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, it is so personal in many ways. And I think that is a lot of it. And you see all these little slim volumes and the thought that within that, you know, you just don't know, like it could be a life-changing poem, right? Hiding right there on this big shelf, but it may be what other people who don't spend as much time as we do, you know, in bookstores feel about books in general. You know, maybe I'm experiencing something that other people who are maybe newer to reading or something like that experience when they go to the bookstore and look at any shelf. But I think it is just that a little bit of an imposter syndrome or whatever. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think what you said is exactly right. It's a balance, because one way to get past that is to have some tools and to have some history with poetry and some experiences with a professor or somebody who knows enough to kind of give you some footing. So I think that is very important. But then I do think it can go too far where you feel like if you don't know exactly what the line structure means and what type of poem this is and some historical context, like you can go down that rabbit hole and kind of get yourself bogged down where you're not really enjoying it. So I like that idea of balance. I think that's right.
I wonder too, and this is kind of a different tangent, but I wonder too how much of this is the, you know, I love Billy Collins. He's also criticized quite heavily of not being a serious poet. His poems are much more digestible. You know, the poem I read this morning probably could have been written as a sentence, you know. And so I wonder how much of it is of their own, of some poets' own making. They have taken away some of the ladders and with the suggestion that these poems aren't poems.
Yeah.
Like Amanda Gorman, you know, I love her poetry, but I also have heard plenty of people say it's, I mean, you know, criticized for various reasons, of course, but also as being simplistic. And I'm like, that just doesn't ring true to me. It doesn't feel simplistic. It feels, you know, it's powerful and I love the images. Another of my favorite poets right now is Andrea Gibson. They're the poet laureate of Colorado, Paul.
Oh yeah, that's right. I knew the name. Yep.
Yeah. They're amazing. And their Instagram is such a great place to go for poetry, but also for their life experiences. And their poetry is usually looking to support people. And I think it sometimes can get discounted as being sentimental, but they're so, I mean, clever is the wrong word, but it is clever. The slam poetry and the wordplay and all of that and the rhythm. But I sometimes think that they're looked down on by other poets, and that can feel like, well, then there's no space for me, you know? Yeah.
No, I think that's very true. I think just like can happen with, you know, literary fiction, where some people are kind of like turned off by that term because they think it's kind of snooty. I think that does happen. And B, I would argue that, you know, it's silly to get hung up in some of that because there's something for everybody. But I do think you're right. I think sometimes poets and other writers do maybe shoot themselves in the foot a little bit by creating this obscure space. I mean, Anthony, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I think there is often a caricature of what we think a certain writer might be like. Maybe we have read some of their work or we've received some of that conversation that you're talking about, but then it's a much different experience when you actually encounter their work. I'm not always plugged in, but it seems like there's been some amount of critical reappraisal of Mary Oliver in the years since her passing, where before it seemed like sometimes there was this idea that, oh, she's just a nice poet that makes you feel good. I mean, first of all, the world is terrible enough. That's a great thing for a poet to accomplish. And kind of an amazing thing that someone would have enough talent to be able to invoke those feelings in you. But further, if you actually go and read a Mary Oliver poem, you realize that she's able to say the things she says because she knows about the suffering and difficulty of life. one of my favorite poems of hers is one when she, it's in her, the first half of her new and selected poems, which is kind of the collected that we have at this point. But she has a poem called When Death Comes. And I mean, it's kind of gruesome. It talks about death as this hungry bear that, like, and there's some real like gory imagery of what it is, but it's also about coming to accept all of those aspects. I mean, similarly, our national poet laureate in the United States right now, Ada Limón, her poetry is totally accessible. It's not this really difficult thing to read, but I find myself over and over again really, really moved when I read her stuff. But as we're having this conversation, I would also just read those poets. Like, if there's someone that you're drawn to and you're not intimidated by, like another person who is a feel-good poet but obviously has very serious things to say about the world and has encountered a lot of the brutality and the violence that exists in the world, and is grappling with that, is a favorite of mine, Naomi Shihab Nye. And her poems, again, you could just take the last line and say, oh, see how this makes me feel good. But really, they're trying to provide some consolation in a world that doesn't always do that. But I would also, what I was going to say is, I would recommend also maybe challenging yourself sometimes. I just read the Michael Hamburger translation of the not complete, but complete or selected poems of Paul Celan that he translated. And Paul Celan is a very difficult poet in a lot of ways. But Celan, during his lifetime, was adamant that he wasn't trying to just be obscure and obtuse and just be like this little hermit that nobody could understand. He was adamant that he was trying to, even though he's doing different things with language because of the very serious subject matters that he's dealing with, he is also trying to create the kind of embodied experience that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think there could be the danger of then feeling like you shouldn't read, or you're almost opposed to these other poets because of that obscure space around. And I just would like to break down all of that and say, well, maybe some of it's for me and some of it might not be, and go with it. Anthony, I had a question for you. If you're comfortable, I think When Death Comes is perfect for also, you know, some of the ideas of uncertainty that we were just talking about. Do you have it and want to read it? I'd love to get some poetry in this episode if you're okay with that.
I'd love to. I wasn't sure how much people had an appetite for or not, but I would love to. So here's Mary Oliver's When Death Comes. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox. When death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades. I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does toward silence. And each body a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world.
I love Mary Oliver.
Yeah, so good. So good. Well, like you said, it's accessible. It's something like, as you listen to that, you can follow it line by line, but it's profound. I mean, it's dealing with the human condition and things that we all worry about. So I think that that's where there's some complexity. It's easy to write off a poet as easy or simple or whatever, but it's like, that's just doing them a disservice, because so many of these people are doing really powerful things, and they're just choosing different ways to do it.
And at least to my ear, as I'm reading it, either aloud or silently, I hear in that, yes, there's one version of it where it's, okay, I'm going to live life to the fullest. I'm not going to simply have visited this world. But I also hear the other side of that, that like maybe there's a little concern or anxiety or doubt that maybe I only have visited. Maybe I'm not, what I love her phrase, maybe I'm not a constant bride married to amazement. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. Maybe I often haven't done that. There, like any of the greatest writing, I hear a kind of multiplicity of meaning where, yes, like encourage me towards this certain thing. And also we all feel a little melancholy because we know all of the times when we haven't lived life in that way.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. And it kind of leads on to maybe another topic, but you know, we're all just chatting around. In fact, I put on here, clearly this is a topic that disturbs a lifetime of multiple podcasts. So we're just sitting down, have conversation amongst friends. But I am curious about some particular poetic moments maybe that you have had in your life, some moments where something just boom, or it, maybe not even that. For example, Marina Sophia on Twitter, she wrote that she received a poem supposedly written for me by a classmate in high school. Discovered it was actually by Octavio Paz. Well, at least it ignited a love affair with Latin American literature. And that's what I'm kind of looking for. It's some ignition of some type, you know. And she says, it's the poem "As One Listens to the Rain," by the way. I can't imagine getting that from someone who's passing it off as their own.
I love that.
This is like a lifetime of love and consideration, and you know my high school friend wrote this to me.
That's so funny.
I love it, but that's kind of what I'm curious about. Or any of those moments where maybe it ignited a love for poetry, or it ignited a love for, you know, a particular poet, or even just it made you stop and think, like maybe for all of us, that Mary Oliver poem just did, as we're listening to those beautiful images and the sounds of the language and the shape of her words as she conveys that. Are there any of those moments for you? I will just, while you're thinking, share one of my, you know, of course, even as a kid, I loved The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. You know, mm-hmm. how do you not just get exactly into that and think that that's great? I'm sure there are people who don't, and that's okay. But I remember in one of my very first literature classes in college, reading The Love Song of J.L. for Prufrock and being absolutely astounded at how much I enjoyed it. And I've thought about that poem. I read that poem often. Mm-hmm. I love the "Let us go then, you and I." And I'm like, who, me and you? What? Who's the you? When the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. And then this line, where I'm like, this is no longer happy. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. I remember reading that for the first time and being absolutely, like, everything else went away. And I was probably just sitting down because I had to read the poem for class the next day. And it became irrelevant you know, that reason for reading the poem. And again, it's something that I just remember. I remember that. I remember reading so many of the poems of the Romantics, you know, Keats and Wordsworth being my favorites, and having those things where I'm like, I was supposed to just read this for a class. Who cares about that anymore? This is something transcendent of that purpose. Yeah. And so I'm just kind of curious about some maybe particular poets or poems or times, reading experiences that maybe come to mind for you.
Yeah. Anthony, do you want to go?
Yeah, I can go. I've had that experience over and over again, both just sort of privately reading things. And actually, I'll just put in a quick aside to say, one of the ways that poetry can become more accessible is hearing it aloud. And so whether that means attending a poetry reading or being in a class where someone reads it, or even I used to be sort of, as a novelist, I used to be against this idea because I thought, oh no, it has to be the letters, the ink on the page. But sometimes if I have enough space to myself, and especially if I'm having trouble accessing a poem, I will just quietly read it to myself. And that causes something else to happen. But I remember in one of my introductory classes as a student, reading Duino Elegies by Rainer Maria Rilke, and that the elegies continue to astound me in my inability to interpret them or have any sort of straightforward meaning, but the power of Rilke's thought and the beauty of it, it just stays with me. I think often of the opening line, it's not the only time that it appears in the elegies, but I think of the opening line of the second elegy, every angel is terrifying. That line is just sort of plays in my head all of the time for whatever reason. Just, I can't even fully express why, but something about everything that is a little bit beyond us, everything that we don't quite have access to. Yes, there's awe and beauty in that, but there's also fear in that. And so that's just one. But I remember reading that and not even fully getting it, but thinking, oh, this is why I do this. This is why I read poetry. This is why I read it all. I had that experience as, I don't know, a 21, 22-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Now, echoing what both of you said, I mean, I definitely had some of those first experiences, obviously, in the classroom. And I remember, like, even something like Kubla Khan by Coleridge, you know, it's like, it's not the same. It's a different approach. And I think that was one of the things that was fascinating about being taught. And especially when you're young and you just are kind of like this blank canvas, you don't even know what poetry can do. And so just seeing the variety of ways that it can be approached. Another one that really stood out from that time was, well-known, but Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And as the professor kind of talked about, that was one where actually having some background really did help me as a student, just knowing that it was about his father and things like that. And so those two within the classroom were very much, you know, times that I remember that stood out for me. I've mentioned this poet quite a few times, and I think one of the reasons that this one stood out to me so much is because it was the accessible issue that we talked about. It was one that I felt like I could approach, and that's Ted Kooser. And in particular, I love his nature writing, but during COVID, I think there was a lot that really resonated with me because a lot of it is also about kind of loneliness and taking these walks in isolation. I know I've mentioned him before, but his collection Winter Morning Walks is just amazing. I think it's he and Jim Harrison, the famous poet and novelist, had this fascinating relationship where they would write like another collection called Braided Creek that I've mentioned before. They just wrote little snippets back and forth, these little tiny poems that were just a few lines, and they're collected in this Braided Creek, but it doesn't tell you who wrote which one. And so it just kind of bounces back and forth. And then his collection, Winter Morning Walks, is actually 100 postcards that he wrote to Jim Harrison while he was recovering from cancer. And they cover the gamut. Some are funny, some are sad, but I wouldn't mind reading one if you guys don't mind. It's real short. It's says January 17th, dark and still at 5:30 a.m. It says, some mornings, very early, I put on my dead father's brown corduroy robe, more than 20 years old, its lining torn, the sleeves a little too long for me, and walk through the house with my father, groping our way through the chilly, darkened rooms, not wanting to waken our wives with a light, and feeling on our outstretched fingers, despite the familiar order of each room, despite the warmth of women sleeping near, the breath of emptiness. And so, like, stuff like that where it's, again, it's simple, it's short, it's very easy to follow, but there's, like, that twist at the end that just, you know, he's grappling with his own cancer diagnosis, he's grappling with what that could mean, and I think there's so much power. So that one, those two collections, the works of Jim Harrison and Ted Kooser during COVID, I think when I was feeling very unsettled and probably, you know, a lot of the things that everyone else was feeling, sometimes when you are interacting with somebody who's going through those same things, it can have that, you know, I don't know if it's consoling, but just facing these realities can be very comforting in a way. So that was another moment for me. And then this one's a little bit out of, this might be taking us in a different direction, but one of the things I appreciate about literature in general and poetry in particular for this conversation is that ability to put you into the lives of other people or experience things that you would not otherwise necessarily experience. And I remember shortly after the George Floyd incident, reading a poem by Jericho Brown, and it's called Bullet Points. I don't know if either one of you have ever read that. I mean, I can read it if you want to. It is super intense.
Jericho is such an incredible poet.
He is. He's amazing. And so this is written from the perspective of a young Black man, and it's basically saying, like, if you find me dead, you know, there's a decent chance that it will be because of something like the George Floyd incident. It's amazing. I would recommend everybody reads that. But I remember reading that one and it just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And it put, you know, there had been so much noise around the George Floyd incident and the many other incidents that happened similar. And of course I was engaged and it was incredibly heartbreaking. But then to read this poem, all of a sudden it just stopped you short and kind of just blew me away. So the power of poetry, I think that one really knocked me for a loop. So those are just a couple of examples of moments in my life where poetry has really had a huge impact.
Nice. I like that you talk about how, you know, they can be short and simple in some ways, but they, and it's not that prose doesn't have the ability to do this at times. I would say my favorite parts of War and Peace made me do this.
Mm-hmm.
Where they, something small, boom, it opens up and takes up so much more space in your, in you and enlarges you in some way, that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And I think poetry is particularly well suited to do that. I was thinking, Paul, about Sylvia Plath. Mm-hmm. We both read Red Comet last year, and a lot of times while we were going through that, there would be maybe a part of a poem, but it really was helpful for me to learn more about her and when these poems were written. And one of the great moments in that book for me was Tulips, you know, learning mm-hmm. more about the background to her poem Tulips, where she's in the hospital and knowing just kind of her past and what she's there for. And I love that poem now. And I love the insight that it gave to me on someone looking for peace in a way that maybe we're not comfortable with.
Yeah.
You know, they're trying to comfort her with tulips, but the tulips are doing the absolute opposite. They're reminding her of something too vibrant, something too sweet. Mm-hmm. And she is more interested in the emptiness and of the white room at that particular moment. And I love that poem. And that, I don't even know if I had really read that poem before reading Red Comet. I can't remember it. Yeah. I may have in school or at some time just glancing through Sylvia Plath's poetry, but that did help me understand her poetry better. I'm not saying every poet, you need to know their biography or anything like that. This poem would have been powerful regardless. But that was the key for me to, I don't know, to find something in that poem that I hadn't before. And that was a fairly recent poetic experience.
But... yeah, that's a great example. And as we said at the time, I mean, Heather Clark's ability within this already outstanding biography, the sections where she was analyzing those poems, that could have been a whole collection by itself. I mean, she is an amazingly talented lady, Heather Clark. But yeah, no, that's a great example. And I will say that that book inspired me to, I added her, Sylvia Plath's kind of collected poems to my list of books that I keep an eye out for now because I've had like, I think I always just read her like in Norton anthologies and like, you know, the ways that you do as an English major, but I definitely am going to make a concerted effort to pick up a collection of her poems and spend some time. Cause yeah, like you said, that Tulips in particular was amazing.
And the work, you know, we've talked, I think, a little bit, and I'm not a poet, but that book also helped me understand a little bit more the deep emotional work of writing these poems and working on them and trying to get the words shaped right and the various lines shaped right to actually reflect the way you want it to be, the way you know, the experience that you're having or want to share with the reader and have them have, that did such a great job of showing her struggling with that and honing things and that life of, I am going to be very, very focused on precision and poetry. I don't have that in my life. that's not me. But I love learning a little bit more about that, and then appreciating even the simplicity that you might find in a Mary Oliver poem is so much not simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's, she didn't just sit down and spout that, you know, that off in 10 seconds, cause that's just what was going on. And I guess even if she did, it still is the result of someone who is thinking and reflecting a lot and then is able to sit down and put something like that together to convey so much. So I love that biography for so many reasons, but
I know.
Yeah, the poetry and the desire to, you know, be a poet.
And almost the inability to not be a poet too. I think that's fascinating how it's just, some people it's just in there, period. I mean, we can take this in other directions, but I do want to make sure, like, Anthony, are there other poets' collections that either are favorites, or one thing I was thinking before the end, I would love to hear, like, are there some books on both of your TBR shelves, some poetry books that are like calling to you? So, you know, we could take that in a couple different directions, but I would love to hear, Anthony, if you have other thoughts on just poems or poets that you want to make sure that you mention during this time.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many, I could go on and on, but the thing that first, well, there's several things that first drew me to literature, but one of the things that first drew me to literature, and I feel like I've heard you guys say similar things before, is that sometimes the actual kind of story or the content of a novel, for example, doesn't matter as much as the way that it's told. And that's in so many ways why I read and why I write. And that becomes even more true with poetry, where a poet is paying so much attention to language. I did want to read maybe very briefly, just maybe, oh, if I've been juggling so many different books, here it is. But again, I mentioned earlier prose from poets, and I also mentioned John Keats letters, but one of the sentences that means the very most to me is one sentence that he wrote in a letter to his friend Benjamin Bailey. And we've also been talking about certainty and uncertainty, and he says, "I'm certain of nothing but of the holiness of the heart's affections and the truth of imagination." And that's just become a sort of guiding principle for me. And as ever with Keats, he he expresses it so perfectly and beautifully. But I think all the time about the holiness of the heart's affections and the truth of imagination. And that's sort of what draws me to poetry. You know, there, one of the, those early experiences with a poet was Gerard Manley Hopkins. And just the way that he sort of totally reinvented the form and the language. He often is inventing new words. Like in Japanese, there's a word komorebi, which means like the play of light between the leaves. If not for Gerard Manley Hopkins, there wouldn't be words for that in English. But he invented the words shivlight and shadow tackle, shivlight being the light that comes between leaves and shadow tackle being also the streams of the shadow that come between leaves. But there, just as you were talking about with Jericho Brown, and as we've been talking about from the beginning, there, poets often return us to the world. They show us the world all around us. One of my favorite poets is Natalie Diaz, and I really, really love her collection, Post-Colonial Love Poem. I haven't read When My Brother was an Aztec yet. I've been meaning to. But one of my favorite poems of hers is The First Water is the Body. It's too long to read the whole thing, but in part of it, she says, we think of our bodies as being all that we are. I am my body. This thinking helps us disrespect water, air, land, one another. But water is not external from our body, ourself. And later on, the water we drink, like the air we breathe, is not part of our body, but is our body. What we do to one, to the body, to the water, we do to the other. And poetry can show us new ways of thinking and new ways of being in the world. And Natalie Diaz is absolutely a poet that does that for me.
I'm so glad you mentioned her, because I held up a copy just now showing the guys like that. I have a copy of When My Brother Was an Aztec, and it's an amazing collection that I was going to mention as another one of those books like Jericho Brown that is so good at putting you into the life and experiences of somebody else in an immersive way and just adding context. But she does it beautifully while tackling some incredibly tough discussions around her brother's addiction and the impact that it had on their family. But that, again, what poetry can do to be able to somehow make that beautiful. She's wonderful. So I'm so glad you mentioned her.
Nice. While you two have been talking, my wife, who she's the one in her text to me, calls herself a creepy eavesdropper. I would never suggest that. But she's been texting. She can't hear you two, but she can hear my part of the conversation. And she has texted me a few things that I thought were, you know, kind of along the lines of what we were talking about earlier of when you are at school. And she said she's learned to really love poetry when she first approaches it as expression. And then, you know, down the line as form and getting into that. But at school, always being approached as form, or as only the second. But also that cerebral aspect made my emotional connection to it feel like I had missed the point. But now, as an adult, at least in age, she says, you two have both been around her. She's great. I feel confident they were the ones who missed the point. And she had a teacher. She's talked to me about this a lot, that kind of always made Emily Dickinson's poems about the riddle, you know, and Paul, I don't even know if we talked about that in our episode on Emily Dickinson, because it seems so irrelevant to all of the things that Emily Dickinson is doing in her poetry and all the beautiful expressions, not trying to crack the nut.
Yeah.
You can do that and you can get there and that can be a moment too, it's not always the point.
Yeah.
You know, the mystery or the all that other stuff is a good point. And she had a good teacher in college that it was kind of fun when she was taking his course, because I learned a lot. It was a world literature course and they read the poetry of Anna Akhmatova. And she said that was a changing point for her, because that teacher wanted to know how each of them had connected to the poems, not whether they had understood the point he decided they needed to understand. And for her, I mean, I remember getting her a book of poetry from Anna Akhmatova because it had just opened up that and you guys were just talking about this, what can be kind of a universal experience and making it very particular, she puts it as able to understand history beyond the facts and figures and get a hint of the personal emotional toll. And I, that's, you were asking, Paul, I still have not read a lot of Anna Akhmatova, even though she's brought up in a lot of the books that we've read for NYRB Women 24 and 23. I haven't read a lot of her poems, so I was thinking maybe that's a good place for me to go. Yeah. But as I was preparing for this episode, and I think every year, I think it's April, it's National Poetry Month. And then all of a sudden it's April 20th. Right. And I haven't done anything to do any National Poetry Month things. And I'd like to change that this year and try to make it so that I am reading a poem a day or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to make it a regimented thing, but I want to make some more intentional poetry reading. Anthony, I think when we met at the King's English, I bought Mary Oliver's Devotions. I can't remember, but I think that might be when I bought it. Oh, and I've read a lot of her poetry before, but I didn't have any of her books. And so I thought I need to get that. And I'm sure it's a big book. There's a bunch in there that I have not read. So that's one that I want to get to. But I would like to go back and read some of these favorite poets that I haven't read in a long time. I mean, Stephen Dunn, as I mentioned before, was one of those that I really loved his work. He won the Pulitzer for Different Hours, 25 years ago. He passed away relatively recently, but I bet there's plenty of more poetry there. And I've only read Different Hours, really, really, really enjoyed Different Hours. And again, I read all of Edward Hirsch's, what's it called? It was a book that was selected and new poetry. Again, I think it's the one that came out before Gabriel. Has fire in the title. I'll get there because I'm looking it up. The Living Fire.
Oh, sorry.
New and selected poems. Yeah. Knopf sent me that in 2010. You know, that's when that came out. And I read that whole thing and I loved it, but I haven't really read it since. Yeah. I've read some poems since when I just thinking about it, but I want to get back and read more of his. There are plenty of Louise Glick's poems that I haven't read that I'd like to read. So I kind of want to spread, but I'd like to make it a little bit more meaningful. And it's also been, this is embarrassing, I told you at the beginning, oh, I love the National Book Award. It always introduces new books. I don't think I've bought very many of them in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I need to do that.
Yeah.
I do want to mention, though, as we've mentioned Louise Glick relatively often in this episode. And, you know, I don't know if this was because of National Poetry Month, but One Bright Book just released an episode on Louise Glick.
Yeah, it's a great episode.
Folks should listen to. I haven't listened to it yet.
It'll be a good one. About the Wild Iris. And also, just like speaking about accessibility and also depth of meaning, the Wild Iris is a collection that seems to be capable of that in a real and really, really interesting and moving ways. But yeah, people should definitely listen to Rebecca, Francis, and Dorian talking about it. They have a great discussion.
Absolutely. And that's one of Louise Glick's poetry books that I have read, but it's probably been, when did she write that? 20 years ago? I mean, I think it won the Pulitzer as well, but that's been a couple of decades. And that's when I read it. I did read her most, she passed away, but the Winter Mythologies, a couple of years ago. Paul, I think of you when I think of it, because it was during the Barnes & Noble post Christmas half off hardbacks. And that is one that I went and bought with it. Yeah. I loved that one. But I also, over the last day, saw that Backlisted podcast, their most recent episode is on Anne Sexton. So there's a lot of poetry in the air.
That's cool.
And a lot of, beyond all of this, some everybody, all our listeners, some of your other favorite podcasts are talking about poets and poetry as well. So I am curious to know where listeners stand on poetry, or where they might, do they have a yearning? Have they been turned off? Do they have a yearning to get back? Do they have experiences? I'm really curious about that, because I think Paul, in the course of this this podcast, we've always been a little bit of not avoiding, but we don't talk poetry too often. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying we're going to change our approach to everything, but I wouldn't mind a little bit more. What have you been reading, and me sharing a poem, you Absolutely. Know, or something like that.
I love that.
I think it would be interesting to, again, to be a little bit more intentional about that. And I'm just curious about listeners, if our conversation or, you know, One Bright Book or Backlisted conversations about these poets make someone say, I do want to read a little bit more. And then please share what you do if you do it.
Yeah,
I'd love to hear more.
Just continuing that theme real quickly of podcasts and poetry. Do either one of you subscribe to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast? It's amazing. I've listened to the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, which some people may be familiar with, where once a month, an author will come on and read a short story podcast that they do, where they'll come on and read a favorite short story by another author. But this is something similar, where the New Yorker's poetry editor, Kevin Young, will have on a poet, and they will discuss a poem by another poet, and as well as one by the poet that they have on there. And that would be just a good way to make sure that you keep poetry in your life, even if it's just once a month. It pops up, you listen to it. The ones I've listened to are very well done, and they cover a wide swath, but they do really do a nice job of that balance we talked about. So I would highly recommend you two and anybody else to check that out.
On that note, the New Yorker, you know, they publish a couple poems every week, and there is a wide variety. Some of them I read and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And plenty of others connect in ways. Betsy, who used to write for my blog on the New Yorker poetry, would go over things like that and just really open up those poems. But also Nancy Pearl, I don't think she does this anymore, but she clips and would put in a notebook some of her favorite poems for the New Yorker, and she would sometimes take a picture and share those on Twitter or, you know, elsewhere nowadays. But I haven't been as active on social media as I used to be, and I don't think she does that anymore. But I wouldn't mind writing her and saying, hey, you don't have to change, you don't have to go back to that, but just so you know, having that moment in the day where I would stop and go, oh, Nancy just shared another one of her favorite poems from the New Yorker's archives, I'll read it. Just again, was that moment of kind of stopping and engaging with that I really appreciated. So the New Yorker is a good place to get insights on new poets. And I didn't even know there was a podcast on it. So that'll be
excellent. It's really good. Really, really good.
Just while we're giving podcast recommendations, and these are two that are easy to listen to because they're always very short, but Pedro Gotuma has the Poetry Unbound podcast that is, I think it's part of the On Being with Krista Tippett family, but he will just choose a poem or a short excerpt of a poem and discuss it just very briefly. And similarly, The Slowdown with Major Jackson, I think previously hosted by Tracy K. Smith, another fantastic poet who I haven't mentioned, and then for a little while by Ada Limon, and then now by Major Jackson, who is a terrific poet in his own right. But those are two, just those sort of podcasts that are less than 10 minutes, and they just read a short excerpt. And so again, you're getting that audio quality of the language, and then they discuss it, not in a, here I'm unlocking it for you sort of way, but hey, like, this really meant something to me, and this is how it might have an effect on your life. Those are both really great.
Well, guys, I need to go, but here's what I'm thinking. It would be fun if sometime over National Poetry Month, we met again and just for a half hour shared some of our favorite poems or something that struck us. And maybe that could be the bonus episode for Patreon and for Substack and others. I hate to limit it that way. We'll kind of see how that all plays out, but a little bit out of our normal recording schedule. Would you two be interested in that? If not, I'll cut this out and not even let our listeners know.
No, absolutely. I'm almost always free around this time when we recorded this, so I would definitely be able to return for that.
Well, let's put that on the plan then and figure that out. I think it would be awesome. I want to get back to talking poetry, but also just maybe a little bit of a bonus episode focused on, you know, a few poems from each of us that we've encountered that we love, and we can discuss them briefly or not. I don't know. You know, I don't know how it'll go, but I think that might be really fun and a good way to carry on this conversation. But I very much appreciate both of you joining me this Saturday morning before April starts. And Paul, does this affect your reading plans at all for the next month or years or life?
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, it's always aspirational, but something like this really gives me some good ideas, whether it's the podcasts, whether it's some of the suggestions that both of you made, and just the discussion in general just gets me excited to dig in. I mean, I have, you know, so many big collections that are sitting there waiting for me. I have some slim stuff that is calling to me. So yeah, I think it absolutely had a wonderful effect, and I'm excited to read more poetry.
Awesome. And Anthony, you probably share it on social media, but again, I'm not exactly always on there, but I'd love to know more or learn more of your experiences with your poetry group on Sundays. Mm. Do you share that on Insta or on Twitter? Like, when are you like, oh, I'm meeting and we're talking about this week. Am I missing that? Or do you?
I haven't usually, I've maybe mentioned it a few times. It was a little bit of a continuation of a class that I took from an incredible poet, Rachel Zucker. And people in that class, or at least a few of them, said, hey, we want to keep the good vibes going. And so it's just been members of that class. Our sort of leader has been moving from Texas to Oregon. And so we've been on pause in March, but it's starting up again in April. And I wouldn't just put the information for it out there, but if someone is interested in joining, they could certainly reach out to me, because it's not like I don't want it to all of a sudden blow up to be 100 people, but like, but also it's not meant to be exclusive. Like, people who want to attend could certainly come. Just as we're closing up, I just wanted to say how much the two of you, both as friends and as presences in the literary world, just mean to me. Like, the kindness and generosity that you've shown toward me personally, and also just the examples that you are, both for the way that you conduct yourselves and the way that you just like devour books. You read so much. Like, if we're talking about aspirations, my aspirations is to read like Trevor and Paul when I grow up. And so just thank you so much for having me on today, because I just appreciate both of you immensely.
Well, thanks for your kind words. Your message to us over the holidays when we did our end of the year, very touching. And we try to emulate the people that we know who make us feel good too. And so you're part of, you know, to the extent that we are any of the things that you are saying, and we appreciate it. It's because of our friendships with folks like you as well. So thank you for your friendship. And I really am excited to get back into this. And we all live close enough together that we will, I know, show up someday at Paul's door.
That's right.
Ready for dinner. And
hopefully with Reuben sandwiches in hand.
We won't tell you though. We'll be knocking.
Yeah. I've always threatened over the holidays, you know, Christmas, like, Paul, what do you guys do for Christmas Eve? Here we are.
Yeah, just show up in your footy pajamas. That would be great.
Thanks so much. Next episode was going to be the Bolaño episode, like I said, but we have to move that. And so Paul and I have slotted in, at least I think this is the plan, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong. The Atlantic did an article on the great American novel recently that I thought was kind of interesting. And our friend Eric Lonesome Reader did a YouTube video on it, responding to it this past week. We talked about a lot of podcasts and such, and now YouTube videos in I'll put them in the show notes, folks. The poetry is a little bit tougher when we just list names, but I'll do my best. But I will put the links to these other bits, but we're going to talk about that article, but maybe span it out to the great American novel and our thoughts on that. I have no idea what Paul's thoughts are, so I'm kind of anxious to learn, but, to the extent that you, listener, have any thoughts on that article or on the great American novel in general, or what you think is the great American novel, or if you think there is no such thing and should not be, I don't care what it is. I would love to hear from you, though. Mm-hmm. And so please share. And that's what we'll be doing here in a couple of weeks. And then we'll make sure that we spread the word about how we're releasing, to the extent that we're, and I think we'll be able to, but you know, right now it's aspirational. Our episode, our follow-up episode, where we share more of our favorite poems here shortly for National Poetry Month. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Goodbye. Thanks, Anthony. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Mooks and the Gripes podcast. You can follow the Mooks and the Gripes and get show notes and book and film reviews at mooksandgripes.com. On Twitter, you can find Trevor at Mooks and Paul at BiblioPaul. You can also get information about future shows on our Patreon. If you'd like to donate to the show, anything and everything, even a dollar a month, helps and is deeply appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/mooks. Until next time.